Okay, welcome back from lunch. I'm going to turn the floor over to Greg Skates and Brian Morris to lead the discussion with regard to related parties.
Thank you, Tom. The topic of related parties was first discussed at the September 2004 meeting of the Standing Advisory Group. Today we'd like to discuss some more topics with respect to related parties and transactions with those parties. First, let's turn to the topic of related parties and fraud risk. The transactions with related parties can provide opportunities for management to perpetrate fraudulent financial reporting. In recent history, numerous enforcement actions brought by the SEC sought a failure to disclose related party transactions. Aside from the potential fraud risk, the board's interim auditing standard on related parties, also referred to as AU Section 334, states that in the absence of evidence to the contrary, transactions with related parties should not be assumed to be outside the ordinary course of business. This brings me to the first series of questions for the Standing Advisory Group to consider. First question, how does the market respond to related party transactions? Are related party transactions perceived as having a higher risk of fraud or error? And second, absence of evidence to the contrary, should transactions with related parties be considered to be in the normal course of business and carry no higher risk of material misstatement than transactions with unrelated parties? Christy Wood.
Thank you. This actually is a topic that CalPERS has a fair amount of experience with. We engage many underperforming companies that, and many of which have related party transactions. And I guess, you know, if I had to send one message to the SAG, it would be that we usually find that where there's smoke, there's fire. And that usually, especially in the post-Enron WorldCom environment, companies that allow, you know, related party transactions when unrelated party transactions are available typically have other judgmental lapses. They have non-independent directors on key committees. You know, they may not always be accounting lapses, but I guess we would find that there are other issues. And so, and many of them, as I said, are not accounting related. But in our observation, I think in our engagement of companies that have governance lapses, we would argue that the presence of related party transactions is usually symptomatic of other, I'm not going to call them ethical lapses, but I would just say sort of judgmental gray areas. And so I do think that these can very often be warning signs of the need to do, I think, take greater care. So I guess I would just want to say from the investor point of view, we look at these with great scrutiny, and especially in the last 5 years. I think, you know, prior to that, it's probably a little bit more prevalent. But in the current environment, I think you really have to wonder what they're thinking. So I guess it's a message of a tone at the top that is concerning. To allow these to continue to exist, when assuming that there are better choices available. And I've never seen a case where there wasn't an equivalent choice. So that's my comment.
Cindy Richardson.
I'd like to echo what Christy said and add a few comments of my own. I think generally speaking, investors view related party transactions as a red flag because it poses a potential for conflict of interest and it creates an agency problem, basically, that can interfere with putting a related party, whether it be a manager, an executive, or a board of director, et cetera's interests, personal interests, ahead of those of share owners. And so that, of course, presents potential for abuse. There's actually a couple of really good studies out there that I'm not sure if you're aware of or not, but there's one on the role of related party transactions and fraudulent reporting that's actually brand new, and it basically looks at 83 SEC enforcement cases where there were related party transactions and fraud, and this includes recent instances of scandals, Refco, Adelphia, Tyco, Rite Aid. So there's a number of very, very high-profile frauds where both elements were present. And the really interesting thing is that the fraud usually occurs at the highest level of the organization. 80% of these cases involve the CEO. 34% of these cases involve the CFO. And a large percentage involved outside parties, and they specifically mention auditors, and brokers. So, again, the potential for abuse is great. There's another interesting study out there about related party transactions in association with corporate governance and firm value, and basically they found a significant correlation between the higher the incident of related party transactions and the higher the dollar amount of those transactions, the weaker the governance generally is in the firm, and generally the lower the stock price. So it has a negative correlation. And in fact, it was found that in both of these studies that related party transactions generally did not benefit shareholders, but in fact could substantially harm them depending upon the specifics of the transaction. And so with respect to treating them as being in the ordinary course, I don't think that would be a good idea, simply because at a minimum, investors deserve full disclosure on these issues, and FAS 57 and SEC Reg SX would accept that if they became viewed as part of the ordinary course of business. And finally, I'd just like to say that the study also, which I thought was very interesting, found that there are types of related party transactions involving fraud that are more frequent. Loans were the most frequent type of related party transaction where there was fraud present, yet relatively few involved direct loans to executives, which is the only type that Sarbanes-Oxley actually prohibits right now. The second most frequent type of related party transaction in these 83 enforcement actions that they looked at, which, by the way, were from as early as they were as recent as 2006 and 1983 is the earliest one that they found. But basically, that involved the purchase of goods and services from related parties where the purchase was either undisclosed, unapproved, or non-existent. And then another frequent type of transaction overall is the sale of goods or services to related parties in which the existence of the relationship was not disclosed and fictitious sales or inappropriate accounting were involved. And financings were another high area of risk. So I just thought that was really interesting sort of background information to sort of launch this discussion. Thanks.
Ted White.
Not to belabor the point, but I would put the same emphasis on as the last two comments. They are very significant issues, and a red flag is a fair term. The only thing I would add is that the normal course of business terminology is something that frankly kind of bothers me. I don't know how a related party transaction could actually be considered sort of normal course of business. By itself, it's something that should deserve specific audit attention. Frankly, if I had my way, I would get rid of that terminology.
Galen Hansen.
Sounds to me like these studies, Cynthia, are pretty interesting. I don't know if there's a way to get a hold of those, but I'd love to read both of those. One thing that happens frequently, and especially with small companies, we frequently get a request that a related party transaction be disclosed as being on the same basis and as that which would occur with a third party. And, of course, there's an auditing standard that says you can't disclose that unless you're willing to audit that assertion. Well, I just wonder whether that might be something that the board might, even though I didn't see it in these materials, that auditing is something to some level that we might consider whether that disclosure is made or not. It seems to me that if you do have transactions occurring with a related party and with non-related parties, that you could make some sorts of conclusions that perhaps should be disclosed. So that's just one thought.
Cynthia Thuber.
Yeah, I think not in all cases, but in many cases, related party transactions certainly indicate that there's a higher risk of misstatement due to fraud. I mean, we saw it in Adelphia and Enron directly related to the fraud. And by the way, the auditors knew about those related party transactions. But I just wanted to point out that in the case of WorldCom, even though there weren't any related party transactions that related directly to the fraud, after the fraud was identified, internal audit found an undisclosed related party transaction related to the chairman of the compensation committee, who was actually leasing a corporate jet from WorldCom for something like $1 a month. And, of course, as you guys know, he approved, the COP committee approved something like $400 million in loans to Bernie Evers. And the way we identified that was in an accounts payable audit. And it was a tip. The accounts payable manager actually came to us and said, hey, look, there, you know, these payments going out to the chairman to reimburse him for some expenses related to this jet, and it looks kind of strange. So, you know, that brings me to the next point, which is I think a good test for related party transactions, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, is to talk to frontline managers, whether they're in the purchasing department or accounts payable, because in all of these companies, and with the frauds as well as related party transactions, there are people who obviously know about this. And while executives at the top of the company and directors may not disclose these related party transactions, there are, I guarantee you, plenty of people in mid-level management on the front line that if we just go in and ask, you know, are waiting for someone to come and talk to them about this.
Bob Gibbers.
I guess a couple things. You know, there are so many stories and so many unpleasant experiences we've all had with related party transactions that have, you know, are somehow nefarious, and yet in business there are so many almost unavoidable related party transactions. You've got one client that does a lot of its work through joint ventures. They happen to make a product, but their natural resources that are their raw material. They set up ventures in different geographies with a partner that has the raw materials. They produce the, you know, the interim goods or whatever. Those are related party transactions, and their co-ventures are related parties by definition because they have joint investments. So some of what has to happen is truly in the ordinary course. But number two up there, you know, is completely turned around. If there's a related party involved, I mean, there's no way you can assume it's in the normal course of business, and there's no way you can assume it carries no higher risk. I mean, almost by definition, it's just the opposite. And so, you know, that first clause is important, absent of evidence to the contrary. That's the whole point. You know, you've got to get to the bottom of it and decide whether or not it's legitimate or not. I do think the latest thinking, though, around this is in the yet-to-be-completed project of the IAASB, and I don't know if you recall, but they had originally had an exposure draft and had a tremendous wealth of comments, some of which caused them, I think, John, to re-expose. And some of the things that were on the table at that time, this is just last year, is recent scandals where frauds had occurred. And to try and align a new related party standard in the audit space with the audit risk model framework. In other words, to get more connectivity there. So I'm not suggesting that the board or the staff, adopt that wholesale. I'm just saying, in terms of current thinking, that body of commentary and the process that's, I think, about to close in a few weeks with the next round of comment letters were probably some of the best information available.
Any other comments on this series of questions? Yes, Chuck Noski.
Interestingly enough, with some of my board work, as the new proxy rules are coming, have come out requiring more disclosure about related party transaction policies, a lot of companies are re-looking at their policies and making judgments about what it is they're going to disclose, which is broader and deeper than we've seen before. So we've done a lot of work on some of my boards in looking what companies are saying, and one of the interesting things we've noticed is that some companies, in describing the management and the board's philosophy about related party transactions, some will require that a related party transaction be on economical terms that are better than they get with a third party. Some will talk about being as good as or approximate, or some will be silent. And so I think this next round of proxy disclosure is going to be very revealing in terms of, if you will, the tone at the top, at the board and at the senior management level, about how they think about related party transactions. So there's going to be a bit more transparency out there. I don't think we should kid ourselves that it's going to be terrific, but I think there'll be a great deal more transparency. And so looking at these new related party transaction policies, which a lot of companies are revamping right now and spending a lot of time with their law firms on, I think is going to be a rich area for somebody to do some analysis about, and probably can inform auditors about their risk assessment.
Arnie Hanisch.
Greg, I've got maybe more of a question than a statement. Is the definition here is it extended to related parties from an operational and business perspective that would involve intercompany transactions with entities that are wholly owned subsidiaries, or is it because I was looking and I was reading ahead, in preparation for today, and it talks about known related party transactions on page 6, arrangements for audits of intercompany account balances. So I mean, is it that broad as far as what we're discussing here, that broad of a definition? Or, as I think Bob was suggesting, because there are normal intercompany transactions or intercompany activities with subsidiaries that are in the normal course of business, to your point up there. Or is this really more related to related parties? Is the intent of this discussion to limit it to related party transactions where there's individuals within the company or board members that may have financial interests in entities that are doing business with our companies?
Well, it's not limited with your it's a broader definition than what you indicated earlier, Arnie. We intend for it to be broader, and that's what the definition is, because the auditor has to determine who are the related parties, and then make a determination then at that time what risks are associated with those related parties.
Well, with that, then I would say, difference to what I think somebody said earlier, there are intercompany transactions that can be in the normal course of business as part of just an overall intercompany relationship with a wholly owned subsidiary, where you have normal transfer pricing and other things that takes place. I think somebody had suggested that it was not in the normal course, I thought.
Any other comments on those first couple of questions before we move ahead? Okay, Brian Morris will introduce the next series of questions for us.
Let's turn to our next topic on understanding the company's related party relationships. The board's interim standard, AU Section 334, outlines audit procedures for understanding a company's related party relationships and also provides an illustrative list of procedures the auditor might perform to identify material transactions with parties known to be related and to identify material transactions that may be indicative of the existence of previously undisclosed relationships. It's really a mouthful. This brings us to our next question, which is, Should the auditor perform procedures for understanding and identifying a company's related party relationships in every audit, regardless of the assessed level of risk? And if so, what should those procedures be? Joe Carcello?
In the document that you sent out to us, you mentioned that what is often done, unless practice has changed an awful lot from when I was in practice, which probably has, but I don't think it's changed here. Essentially what was done is you get a list, if you were lucky, from someone ahead of you on the engagement team and say, here are potential related parties. And that was pretty much it. And it was not what I would call a very structured process to search for related parties. It was very much ad hoc. And I think given the risk surrounding related party transactions and the fraud situations, and bluntly, given the growth today of electronic tools to both access the GL 100% and access public database records on private companies and potential businesses that the company may have arrangements with, for firms to not be doing more now doesn't seem very defensible to me. And so I think the board should think seriously about this particular issue in providing more structure and guidance to the firms in terms of what's expected of them in trying to identify related party transactions. Because let's be blunt about it. If there's a massive fraud, and I'm the CEO, and I've created a shell private company to perpetrate the fraud, I'm not going to tell you about it. And so that's really the risk.
I think Howard was actually first on that, so Howard Johnson.
Yeah, I think there ought to be some scrutiny of this area every audit. I think there's a lot you can look at from what's going on within the company as far as looking at this area as some independent function like, say, internal audit or legal or loss prevention or somebody else like that. Taking a look for at related party type transactions, has internal audit audited the sourcing process lately? What were the findings? What happens with sole source agreements? Do they have, you know, a process for those type of exceptions where you wouldn't go out and bid? And are those really being adhered to? I think there's a lot of inquiry you can make as to what the company itself is doing to look at this area. If you don't get many good answers, or people aren't looking at it, or it's not on somebody's plan or independently checked, I would be highly skeptical of what's going on. So I think besides just before jumping into and doing some more of the perfunctory stuff, just a lot of inquiry and observation and reading whatever has been published on this area within the company could be helpful.
Damon Silvers?
This is obviously an area where both there's the transactions themselves should be sort of given heightened scrutiny in light of the possibility that there are going to be some sort of material omission or failure to disclose or mischaracterization is going on. There's every incentive on the part of many people to do that in these types of transactions. But even more importantly, because they are a potential roadmap to things that are much more serious that even than the transaction itself. And I'll just take a rather well-worn example of this, which is that there was a related party transaction aspect to the special purpose entities at Enron. That aspect of those entities was not the beginning or end of the problem. But once you understood what the related party transaction was, then clearly anyone with half a brain could figure out that there are now 20 more questions you need to ask and ask very quickly about a whole range of matters that turned out to be the keys to the overall fraud as a whole. So that's the backdrop against which the importance here I think that what you have proposed in ISA 550 is a very good list of specific requirements that need to be gone through. And I would focus on one in particular, which is the requirement to look at minutes of meetings of shareholders and of those charged with governance. I assume that that's a catch-all category that includes the board. My own experience in identifying dealing with improper behavior is that board minutes are critical. Most of the worst stuff is signposted there someplace, right? And you have to be reading them with an eye toward, you know, what are these minutes telling you as an auditor about what transactions are going on with related parties, and of course, as is usually the case, the things they're trying to hide are, you know, it's like three words someplace, or you know, and not just the full board, by the way, but the committee minutes. And I would hope that this line here in this briefing document would be a little more fully threshed out in the actual document. I think that specifically directing auditors to review those documents, board minutes, board committee minutes, to the extent there may be, if you're talking about, say, a financial institution, there are committees that review and approve transactions generally, looking at those sorts of minutes as well. That's the critical place to be. And so I would just sort of highlight that as one aspect of why I think this is a very good list.
John Kellis.
Thank you. I think your question sort of conflates understanding and identifying, and I think understanding is the key to this, and that in any audit which directs itself to those areas of greatest risk and importance, you must understand what you're looking at and understand the business and its business and commercial relationships. When we did the initial exposure draft, we got a lot of pushback on the second aspect of that, the straight identifying, which is, for the reasons already mentioned, it is going to be extremely difficult to identify related party relationships and transactions that people wish to conceal from the auditor. It is simply too difficult. And I think that's why the combination of understanding commercial relationships and, when it comes to identification, being alert to the possibilities of related party transactions. So when you are reading the minutes or when you're dealing with any transaction at all, is that the possibility of related party relationship here that might affect the transaction, particularly if its commercial rationale doesn't quite seem right. But it would probably be an unjustified burden to place some sort of specific obligation on the auditor to identify related party transactions in all circumstances.
Sam Renzler.
I agree with John Kellis. I think there is incumbent on an auditor to do some work around the understanding of related party relationships. I don't know how you can not, in order to assess the level of risk, you have to be able to assess, you have to have an understanding of the transactions themselves. So I think just a risk assessment process would require you to look at related party transactions and then to at least obtain an understanding around the company's controls. But I don't think because there's related party transactions, you immediately go to forensic auditing in an attempt to find unidentified related party transactions. You might, but there's, I think, other risk factors that come into play before you start searching the archives of the company record system in the United States looking for related party transactions.
Joe Carcillo.
A couple of points. One point, it's a little bit off this question, but I think relevant, that was mentioned in the Henry et al. Briefing paper or the Horizons paper that you mentioned as background, is that when there are related party transactions, particularly if they involve directors, and those directors have been classified as independent. They're really not independent anymore. At best, they're gray. And so that really, the literature on gray directors is a little bit more nebulous than on insiders, but it's problematic enough to suggest that there needs to be a cycle back on the part of the firm to their evaluation of the control environment. And maybe they're doing that, maybe they're not. I mean, again, that's something you could look at as part of your inspection process. But it would seem to me that you need to think about what that says for the overall control environment, the evaluation of controls on the 404 and so forth. Getting to this issue of identification, I think this is a tricky issue because I certainly am sympathetic to what John and Sam are saying, and to have a full-blown forensic audit, I don't think anybody's advocating that. On the other hand, if the only responsibility is to evaluate those related party transactions that you are aware of or that management makes you aware of, again, the ones that are going to be the most problematic are, by definition, going to be the ones that management tries to hide from you. So that makes me nervous to say there's not a responsibility there to identify. The auditor, as we know, has to design the audit to provide reasonable assurance that financial statements are free of material error, whether caused by error or fraud. And so in this case, we're talking about fraud in some cases with related party transactions. I went back and read the briefing paper that you put together for the 2004 meeting on this topic, and you referred to the QCIC report in 2002, and now I quote, "New ideas for identifying difficult to find related party transactions should be investigated and guidance issued." So again, that's the QCIC in 2002, before Sarbanes-Oxley, before you guys were created. It's hard to argue that after the events of the last 5 years that the recommendations in that report are any less germane today than they were 5 years ago. And I do think there are ways to use technology today, short of a full-blown forensic audit, that could help us identify transactions with unusually high profit margins, particularly close to year-end, where cash doesn't change hands. You could identify the company involved in that transaction. You could run it against CompuStat to see if it's a public company. If it's a private company, by definition, unless you know the ownership structure of that private company, there may be more risk involved. And so what I'm suggesting here is not, I don't think, a massive undertaking on the part of firms.
Lynn Turner.
The issues, if you look through some of these where they've been most problematic, Enron, which we're certainly all aware of because of not only the SPEs, but some of the other transactions that they did, Adelphia, Parmalat, Tyson's Food in the recent court case made it very clear that these were issues out there, and it wasn't so much a matter of identification. People knew about them. The auditors knew about the related party transactions. So the identification, which makes sense, you got to go do, and you probably got, you absolutely have to go further than just inquiry. Too much of this is built around inquiry, and so you're going and you're asking a management team that if there's a problem, you're going to go and ask the management team that designed the related party transaction that isn't all above board what it's all about and whether it's kosher. And they aren't going to sit there and tell you, no, we're doing a related party fraud. So inquiry of management doesn't work in this area. That's almost a worthless, you know, waste of time, you know. It's doing other things that, like the hedge funds on Enron did, to get an understanding of what was going on with the related party transactions, the SPEs, and why they were there and what was the business purpose behind them. And you don't get that by going and asking management. You don't get that by going and asking Jeff Skilling, why do you have SPEs set up? Or Andy Fastow. They aren't going to tell you. You have yourself got to go through procedures, given whatever the specifics are, to really gain an understanding of what the business purpose is behind it. And if you as an auditor don't get that understanding, you are going to miss the boat. And it wasn't in
Enron and Tyson's and Parmalat, you know, Adelphia, people knew about them. They had been identified. But in those cases, they didn't deal with what's the real business issue and real substance, and then that's the piece that didn't get really reflected in the financials and disclosure. That coupled with the fact that too often related parties tend to be work that's done at the end of the audit as opposed to earlier on with substantive work. It's a footnote disclosure. Yeah, it may be broken out online in the P&L, but that's a breakout. There just isn't enough time, and it's not senior enough. Any standard should say related parties in and of themselves create heightened awareness. And any auditor that doesn't view related parties with heightened awareness and skepticism is starting off on the wrong foot. And so I'd say they need to be heightened awareness in this area. Focus on it. You can inquire of management. Certainly good management will tell you where things are. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is understanding why is it that people are doing the related parties? What's the real business transaction? And inquiry by and in of itself doesn't get you that. And if you can't figure out what's really going on, you're not done, either from a communication perspective with investors or with respect to the audit.
Jeff Stanoff.
I'd like to echo the point that Joe made. I don't think you can understand them without having some idea as to what they are. I think those two things go together. I think the issue here is to what degree. I'm appreciative of the point that John and Sam made. How can you identify all of them? But there has to be some level. I think the proposed International Standard 550, I think, provides a good principle basis. I think the important part here is the second part of your question. What should the procedures be? If the board could define in some way some parameter that didn't head you down the road that John and Sam were concerned about, the auditor having to find every one of them and not ever knowing if they had found every one of them, to something that was reasonable. And something that would give you a basis to understand, because without really identifying at some level what they are, you can't understand what they are. I think that would be a good service, whether that's part of a standard or other guidance. But really, I think the second part of your question gets to the nature of it. I think they have to perform do something to identify them. But how much is really, I think, the difficult question.
Arnie Hanisch.
Yeah, I guess just to go on record, I guess I support most of what's being said here as far as additional procedures that need to, to gain an understanding and identifying companies' related party relationships. But we just clearly need to not let this get out of control to the point where we're suggesting in standards that we would have to undertake some sort of a forensic audit activity. I think that it's when I hear people talk about forensic auditing, we hope it's not in the context that we would clearly go down that path, because I think that would be a mistake. So, but absent that, I think clearly there's a need to for the auditor to understand and perform additional procedures to get satisfied that there's nothing going on with respect to inappropriate related party transactions. I do want to, though, again, come back to the point I made earlier that there needs to be some differentiation, at least in my view, between what I perceive to be related party transactions with businesses that might be owned by a particular individual or board member versus a wholly owned subsidiary of a company where you have normal intercompany transactions in the normal course of business. And it shouldn't be that broad with respect to transactions, because I think you've got other parts of your audit. The other parts of the audit process around the tax auditing that relates to the transfer pricing issues that crop up when you have intercompany and related party transactions that are probably already covered as part of the normal audit.
Cindy Hanisch. Cindy Cooper?
Yeah, I agree with Lynn that the most important thing is to understand the business purpose behind the transactions, and that we can't rely on management inquiry. So it sounds like everybody agrees that there are certain minimum procedures that should be performed on every audit. And so we've talked a lot about principles based today. I would be interested in just hearing from some of my colleagues as to whether or not this is a case with related parties where we should have perhaps a more prescriptive approach in the standards. Ben or anybody?
Happy to go.
You're right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, my reaction to this question was, and maybe the one before it, you know, when you're beginning to think about assess level of risk, and in my experiences, when you have an organization that has a high level of related party transactions itself identified, your level of risk is up by definition, to Lynn's point. And there are environments where there are businesses that are susceptible to more business transactions among related parties, and your risk assessment should be very different, and you should be amending your procedures in reaction to that. And that's very different than going across and prescribing to go through procedures. If you're going to go and begin to add procedures like that, I think you need to be very careful you're not going to go into some of the discussions we've had between AS2 and AS5, because right away you're going to have a cost-benefit scenario that I do think that was brought up before very, very quickly. You put a procedure there of searching, so forget about that environment, because it's a very different environment, and then you have a normal course of business where you're trying to look at related party transactions at two levels, because I've heard two levels here. One level is one that could have a direct effect on the financial statements, right? A normal course of transaction. And another one, say the example that you used, would be perhaps not a effect on the level of financial statements, but gosh, the board and other people should really know, and investors should know about that transaction, right? And if you look at 57, it has a pretty low level. I haven't read it in a while, but I think it says something like related party transactions need to be disclosed regardless of materiality. All right. So with that standard, the auditor already has a responsibility in assessing the financial statements and the efficacy of the disclosures that all related party transactions, regardless of materiality, disclosed in the financial statements. They are all very principles-based. You started putting rules about how you're going to do that. I would ask you to think about, before you do that, the various nature of the related party transactions, because they're vast. Right? And when you try to start putting individual procedures, you're going to have people going down and spending an awful lot of time in a checklist format for which your ROI on those procedures are not going to be very high. So I would tell you, I'd go back to the principles based, the characteristics of what you're looking for, and when you're in those characteristics, these are the types of procedures that you should be considering and doing.
Damon Silvers.
In response to the prior comment, I think there is this third category I want to emphasize again, which is not the category of transactions that are, in and of themselves material, nor the category of just making sure to identify all related party transactions pursuant to the existing standards, both of which should be done. But what I would like to see in terms of the standard here is that auditors are instructed to engage in an analysis that flows from the question of what is the business purpose of this transaction to the question of what is this transaction telling us about the integrity of the larger financial statements, if anything. Because in many ways, I think what recent experience tells us is that potentially the greatest value of looking closely at related party transactions is not so much the transactions themselves, although they can be very important, but the window that they give you into perhaps other things that are going on that may be much larger in scale. And here I think it's worth being quite specific about instructing the profession as to what the thought process ought to be here, and so that the, regardless of how experienced the auditor may be, there's this little there's a checkbox, and then says, "Have I thought about what the implications are of what I'm finding of each of those may or may be not material items, but are they leading you to other material items that ought to be of concern?" So I just want to make clear that. So that's, I think, a third category that really we ought to have specifically addressed.
No, I'll just add to that, because I think what you're really addressing is the intersection of related party transactions and the SAS 99 standard, right? And the heightened risk of fraud based on the nature and the relationships of the related party transactions. And perhaps that is the place that you would, you know, address your concern, because it really is, you know, a very practical element of the implementation of SAS 99.
The point I'm making is that they are a guidepost to other things, right? That there is some history that suggests that when larger misconduct is involved, or when a larger effort is underway to misrepresent the financial statements, that effort somehow has a related party transaction element to it, right? That there's a place where a little bit of direct self-enrichment goes on, or a place where the insiders are trying to protect themselves against the risks of what they're doing with the company as a whole, and so that if you start pulling that string, right? I mean, I guess what I'm looking for here is language that tells the auditor to start pulling the string, right? And I guess that's a fine term of art there, but you guys know how to translate that into the terms of art.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move on to the next question, which is actually somewhat related to this this topic. So, and I saw Dick Dietrich put his card up, so I'm going to read the question, and then I will you can answer this question and then the previous one as well. Just a little tee up, and that is that the existing standard on related parties goes on to state that an auditor should place emphasis on testing material transactions with parties known to be related to the reporting entity. And the standard further outlines illustrative procedures that the auditor may perform when testing related party transactions. So the question we're going to pose to the SAG is, are there specific types of related party relationships or transactions that pose a higher risk? And if so, should the auditor perform additional procedures? And I guess based on this morning's discussion, that's going to draw some reaction as well. So, Dick Dietrich?
Yeah, since I perceive that there appeared to be a choir of consensus around the idea of related party transactions, I actually want to play devil's advocate for a minute and say, let's suppose that a new standard is developed that says that the auditor is required to identify all related party transactions and understand the business nature of those transactions. I predict that there will be pushback along two lines. The first line will be, this is simply something that's going to drive up audit fees with no commensurate benefits to investors. And the second is that corporations will argue that they are no longer able, or because of this concern, they're less likely to be willing to engage in related party transactions, which some will allege will harm investors because it will force them to engage in less profitable transactions than these related party transactions, which they will assert are somehow more beneficial to their stockholders. So I guess the question I have for others is, are those plausibly logical complaints that have any validity, or are they simply the kinds of criticisms that I perceive will hear with no validity?
Joe Carcello?
I have a response to what you have up here on the board, and that is, are there specific types of related party relationships or transactions that pose a higher risk? It would seem to me that any type of related party transaction, in particular with top management, especially the CEO or the CFO, we know that over 80% of all frauds, at least as documented in SEC enforcement actions, involve the CEO and or the CFO. And so if there's a related party transaction between the company and them, including with their families or other businesses that they control, would seem, that doesn't mean automatically it's fraud, but it would seem to pose higher risk, those types of transactions. I think also a related party transaction that's identified by the auditor that's material that was not disclosed to the auditor by management. I think any time the auditor has even the possible suggestion that there may be lack of top management integrity, that top management is lying to them, I think the risk profile and the level of skepticism needs to go through the roof.
Sam Renzillo.
Let me expand a bit on Joe's thoughts. I agree with his list. I'd also agree that non-cash transactions ought to send off usually an alarm, and I'd like to think that that if an auditor finds a client that is lying to it, we'd like to refer to those usually as former clients. But again, a lack of controls in the area of related party transactions, which, of course, in an integrated audit, there will be some work around that. And even in a financial statement audit, I don't know how you audit related party transactions without understanding the company's controls. But even a lack of controls would, in my mind, be a fraud risk factor that ought to move an auditor into sort of a separate line of thinking. That doesn't mean it immediately moves you to forensics, but it ought to send off some lights, and you do have a higher risk.
Bob Tirola.
Yes, thank you. I agree with what most everyone has said, that related party transactions should be presumed to have an inherent risk different from unrelated party transactions. But I submit that if you look at your client's procedures around identification and monitoring of related party transactions, that you may find easy ways to audit the existence as well as the accounting implications. For instance, ethics certifications, conflict of interest certifications, transfer pricing policies, and the like, currency management policies. There are inherent controls around related party transactions that I think if you, as auditors, believe your client has a robust set of ways both to identify and to monitor, I think you'll feel better about the situation. If you don't see those controls, I'd say additional is probably a good word.
Randy Fletchall.
I wanted to respond to Dick's question. I think I may not have heard you correctly, but I thought I heard you say if the standard required an auditor to identify all related party transactions and then evaluate, get an understanding. I guess you posited that would an auditor drive up cost? I think clearly it would, but similar to our other discussions on SAS 99 in this forum, it also might be an impossibility. Cannot say you're required to identify every piece of fraud or every related party transaction. You can require one to seek to and go to great efforts to, but again, I think everyone realizes that there will be instances of collusive fraud that you just can't say it's a requirement that you would identify those. And we're back to kind of you're way beyond reasonable assurance into absolute assurance, and the cost, I think the price tag on that is bound to be prohibitive.
Damon Silvers.
Yeah, I too wanted to address Dick's question. I think, but first in response to what Randy said, I'm not sure anyone here is advocating an absolute liability scheme here. That's just not, for the reasons he stated, that's not a reasonable one. I think that certainly what I have in mind around this issue is that there should be some specific instructions as to how to proceed, not a rule that if some devious person is successful at somehow hiding something from you that you had no reasonable expectation of being able to find, that you're on the hook for that. That's I don't think anyone's advocating that. Dick, it struck me that the question you were asking was something like this. there are, if you have a higher level of attention on the part of an audit standard to related party transactions, that there will be costs associated with audits there, and that assume for the moment that there are benefits associated with related party transactions, that they're being undertaken for good faith, for valid business reasons. Right, that in some cases those audit costs will exceed the benefits associated with those transactions, and thus they wouldn't be undertaken. That's the hypothetical you posed to us. My reaction to that, which I think most investors would share, is that since you're sort of standing from this outside, you're standing outside this sequence of events without perfect knowledge about people's good faith and so on and so forth, that any transaction that's so economically marginal that the audit cost kicks it into the disadvantageous position, any related party transaction that's so economically marginal that characterization applies, is one that's not worth the risk that in fact it's not good faith.
Lynn Turner.
Certainly the mentioned by Sam and Joe about transactions with management being of concern, I think, is true. And again, if management hadn't told you about it, then Sam's right. It should be former client. Although I remember one a few years back that Bob's firm went out and said former client. Vince went out and said new client. So... you know, one man's loss is another man's gain. I think Bob won. But there's another type of transaction here that from a related party is, I think, even of more concern than the ones with management and require even more attention. And they are the structured transactions with the related party, where people have structured them with that related party. We certainly saw that at Enron. We certainly saw it at AIG. In both cases, the auditors were aware of it. And we're now starting to see it pop through in securitizations. And we've seen it as securitizations, including some banks. And when people start doing these structured transactions with a related party to get a desired result, I think it even gets more heightened risk than one even with management. I would be more concerned about it. So I'd certainly have structured transactions on that list as well.
Thank you, Lynn. Any other comments on this question? Let's move ahead to the next couple of questions. The identification of undisclosed relationships is generally regarded as one of the most challenging aspects of an audit. Again, referring to the board's interim standard on related parties, AU Section 334, provides that auditors should be aware of the possibility that transactions with related parties may have been motivated by management to achieve certain financial results. This leads us to our final series of questions here on related parties. To what degree should the auditor be expected to search for and identify undisclosed related parties and transactions with those related parties? Are there certain procedures that the auditor should perform in each audit, or should the auditor be expected to determine those procedures based on the assessed risk of undisclosed matters? If based on risk, how should the auditor be directed to assess the risk of undisclosed related parties and related party transactions? Comments? Lynn Turner?
Greg, one thing I come back to in this area is from time to time we see where Wall Street has found the related parties, but the auditors don't. And the auditors seem to look at what's in front of them. And they don't go out and do the type of things that Wall Street does in terms, and analysts do in terms of looking, especially with the internet out there today. I find it more than interesting that analysts can find some related party stuff. There was some on Dell a couple years ago. We found things where it's out there in public records, and people just haven't gone and looked. Time and time again, we'll find a simple search on Google. We'll turn around and turn up things. So I'd ask that you turn around and reach out to some of the Wall Street people and take a look at what are they doing where they're able to identify these things and these relationships. But the auditors haven't, and I think it's because the auditors tend to audit what's in front of them and put in front of them and don't go out beyond that. And so I think that the steps that we're doing aren't sufficient. And quite frankly, then when you have an audit, you've had a significant related party, it was out there and Wall Street could find it, but the auditors couldn't find it. Every time the public is going to turn around and say, it's just not acceptable, and we want restitution. And if that's what the public, investing public in essence, is going to do and want, then you got to figure a way to get auditors out beyond just what's in front of them.
Cynthia Cooper?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Lynn said about getting auditors to think out of the box. When we tested for related parties, looking for unidentified related parties at WorldCom, that's exactly what we did. We went out and got on the internet and we Googled. And we looked for, you know, directors and officers and other associations. They may have companies they may be involved in, where they, you know, they may have a percent ownership or whatever. And then we looked for the transactions. And we actually identified quite a few undisclosed related parties just by doing that. So I think it is important for auditors to think outside the box.
Bob Tirola.
Yes, and to that end, I would submit that the backdating was an undisclosed related party issue. And I think as auditors, you need to engage corporate counsel and outside counsel of the enterprise in a much more direct and robust way to ask some probing questions of the legal staff, who often, I believe anyway, could know much more about the insider transactions than frankly the CFO or the accounting staff. And so don't ignore that part of the organization.
Joe Carcillo.
I want to follow up on what Lynn said a little while ago. You might want to think about, too, whether it would be useful to provide guidance on how related party transactions might be designed to facilitate certain types of misstatements. It seems to me that structure transactions, as Lynn talked about, are probably most likely to be used to perpetrate fraudulent financial reporting. And self-dealing is really an issue of misappropriation of assets. And I think where that's particularly something to be concerned about, as I understand it, is about 1,500 foreign registrants listed with the SEC. One of the characteristics of some of those foreign firms is that voting rights, in some cases, substantially exceed economic rights. And so one of the big governance issues with foreign firms, particularly closely held foreign firms, is tunneling, where essentially what will happen is the controlling shareholder, because they may have 80% of the votes but only 20% of the economic stake, they'll self-deal assets to a private company that they own 100% of the economic stake and essentially expropriate wealth from the corporation, the public corporation, to that private corporation. And I don't know how many U.S. auditors, given the context that we've been trained in, even tend to think that way.
Silvana Palmrose.
Oh, three items that probably don't relate to any of the questions you have here, and
may not relate to each other. But first of all, this topic was on the SAG agenda in 2004, and so it's one area where, again, we could ask the question or pose the question, what have we learned from the inspection process that would help us with this issue? Are there questions that have arisen in that context, and how would that inform the standard setting process? The second point is from the paper, the Accounting Horizons paper, that is the synthesis paper on research in the area. I thought it was interesting in that it actually talks about an important distinction, which is whether related party transactions involve a disclosure issue or whether they involve a financial statement effect. And it turns out the disclosure tends to have an important role here. And so, again, thinking about the potential impact on standards, it seems to be important to think about whether we're talking about disclosure issues or whether we're talking about financial statement amounts. And then that relates to the third item, which is one of materiality. And one of the other issues that comes through not just this research paper but others is this issue of materiality with respect to disclosures versus financial statement effects. And again, thinking along those lines and how that relates to related party transactions may provide some insight from a standard setting process.
Bob Kippers.
You know, in thinking about this, there probably are definitely opportunities for us to do a better job in this arena. I mean, I haven't pored over all the commentaries surrounding, ISO 550, but even that draft standard talks about, being alert for arrangements. That's very different than testing a list of related parties for understatement, specifically, positively testing. So I was thinking what Lynn said, Cynthia, some others. I would think there's things we could do. I mean, alert would mean I'm sending out a confirmation. I happen to note that the public warehouse I'm sending the confirm to is the CEO's home address. You know, that would be alert. But, I mean, that's sort of like lucky. You know, you just have to put two and two together, and it doesn't, provide me a lot of comfort that there have been some positive audit steps taken to to test that listing for understatement. So maybe there is some opportunity there.
Galen Hansen.
Again, dealing with smaller issuers, on the exchanges, there are now minimum equity requirements, and we're seeing from time to time companies dealing with related parties to try to write up assets, and the predecessor cost rules of the SEC have been around for quite some time. I would suggest that perhaps those could be somehow codified into the auditing standards. And then to follow up on Zovana's comments, I don't think it's just disclosure and financial statement effects. I think there's also a third category, and that would be the reporting requirements. I really question whether the auditor's report would be a place to reflect some of what's going on in the company. And to expand on that, you do occasionally see so many transactions. And let's face it, the measurement standard in accounting is supposed to be arm's length. And this gets thrown out the window with related party transactions. So when you're dealing with related party transactions, on occasion there are so many of them and they're so pervasive, you have to ask yourself whether the financial statements can be possibly presented fairly when they're riddled with related party transactions.
Others who would like to comment on this last series? Or any other comments? Lynn Turner?
Let me add one other criteria to think about, and that is geography. We've been talking about this from a U.S.-centric perspective. Anyone that's doing business in some of the emerging countries today realize that this is an extremely problematic issue for people in their business dealings. Knowing exactly what's going on with your marketing group and people in China, Russia, even Japan has had some problems. Korea certainly has had a lot of problems in this area as well. And we've had problems with, I think it was CNOC, the Korean Chaebols, Learnout and House B had some problems in this area. And people, you know, especially when you have China, who has come out and said by law, we're not going to do related party disclosures, we're not really going to adopt DIFFRs. And in fact, I had a meeting with representatives of the board of the largest telecom in China last November, and they came in and they said, Lynn, what do we do when the Chinese government asks us to do something that's not in the best interest of our minority shareholders? They controlled something like 75% or something like that. And so when you've got that attitude and culture out there, then I think you're in a whole new ballgame from an auditing perspective. You can't audit those companies the same way that we try to audit those companies here in the U.S. And if an audit firm is going to approach the audit of those companies where you got those type of cultures, and even the government has indicated that they're going to operate outside the boundaries of normal standards for the rest of the world, then you as an auditor, again, those aren't heightened awareness. Those are big-time problems, and I think they create some real audit issues, if not some real significant disclosure issues, because if you've got a government saying you don't have to disclose it, I don't know how an auditor in China these days is going to ensure that they've detected and disclosed all the related party transactions, because the government has said it's okay not to do that. And I think that is a very serious problem in the emerging countries and in China, especially with the government's position.
Any other comments or concluding comments on related parties? Okay, then we will move over to the next part, and the last part of our meeting, and I'll turn it over to Tom Ray.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, everyone. So we'll move over into our discussion of emerging issues. As I mentioned this morning, we identified a couple of matters we would like to address, and it looks like we're going to have time to address both of them. Joining us up here is Marty Bauman. Marty is the director of our Division of Research and Analysis, or Office of Research and Analysis, I should say. Marty recently took the job succeeding Phil Wiedemeyer, who is another PCAOB senior staff who's decided to move on to other opportunities, and we're all going to miss Phil. I have to take the opportunity to say that and wish Phil the best of luck. But let me turn it over to Marty, who has agreed to tee up this issue for us. Thanks, Marty.
Great. Thanks, Tom. One of the areas that my office has been monitoring is the subprime mortgage market and the potential broader risk that might emerge from the warning signals being sent from that market. We would like to seek the input from this group on the potential threat of the subprime shakeout and what the auditing profession should be alert to and should be doing in connection with these potential risks. First, let me give some background information. Total mortgage debt outstanding for single-family homes was approximately $10 trillion at the end of 2006. Of that, subprime mortgage debt outstanding was about $1.2 trillion, and Alt-A mortgages, those are higher quality mortgages than subprime, but less so than conventional conforming mortgages, were about $700 billion, or combined those two categories were about $2 trillion, representing some 20% of the mortgage market. Bankruptcies and business failures of subprime mortgage companies have accelerated. In early 2007, New Century, the nation's second largest subprime lender, filed for bankruptcy, and to date more than 30 other mortgage lenders have gone out of business. According to various sources, about $320 billion of the subprime mortgages remain on the balance sheets of the largest banks and mortgage originators. This implies over $800 billion in outstanding subprime mortgages are in securitizations and held by secondary mortgage investors. Problems are beginning to emerge with credit-related hedge funds and associated investment banks that have lending, counterparty, or other prime brokerage relationships with hedge funds. As recently as today, the press continues to report about the difficulties that two Bear Stearns-related hedge funds are experiencing after sustaining losses on subprime investments. These two funds are reported to have over $20 billion in investments, including mortgage-related securities and complex CDOs. One analyst today said that, quote, at best, this is an embarrassment for the firm, and at worst, it threatens to have a ripple effect on valuations across the subprime sector. Loan modifications are also being recommended as a key regulatory response that the banking and mortgage service industry should employ. The chairman of the FDIC recently called for the mortgage industry to modify subprime loans to the maximum extent possible rather than force foreclosures on homeowners. Securitization rules under FAS 140, however, which allow mortgage securitizations to be treated as sales with gain on sale recognition, may not permit such modifications. If FAS 140 rules are violated, this could result in a significant amount of mortgages coming back onto the balance sheets of the companies that originally securitized them. Further, there are many other mortgage-related assets that financial institutions hold which require regular valuation, including mortgage servicing rights, retained interest such as IO strips from securitizations, and loans held for sale. And finally today, the FT reported that the ABX derivative index, which tracks home loans made to subprime borrowers, dropped to a record low yesterday. So with that backdrop, I'd like to ask the group to address the following two questions. First, to what extent do you believe the troubles in the subprime mortgage market are signaling a significant financial reporting risk? Related to this is an implicit question of whether you foresee the troubles in subprime spilling over beyond the subprime lenders into mortgage securitizations, the broader mortgage market, other consumer debt, or other industries such as home builders. And second, if you believe there are significant danger signals and threats here and the potential for financial reporting risks, what advice would you give to the audit profession and what should auditors be doing to be certain that financial reporting around these risks is fair, transparent, and appropriately audited? So with that, I'd like to ask the group to open the floor for comment and seek your input.
Lynn Turner. Leroy Dennis.
Well, I want to add a third question to the list, because I get subprime lending now. There's all kinds of risks there, and we're all acute to it. And I can kind of make through in my mind, okay, it's going to affect housing and banking, and can figure that out. What I think would be very valuable to the auditing profession and the business community is, what's the next subprime lending? What characteristics are out there in that group that relate to, that we see here, that are similar in another industry, so that we can predict that we ought to be looking closer at that industry as opposed to a retrospective look back rule on subprime lending. So I would add a third question to your list.
Damon Silvers.
Well, I'll respond to Leroy's question, which is that I think that one of what we are seeing here in part
First, in terms of what you should be looking at, I think you've already identified it. From what I can tell, the key issue here is who's got the puts, and where are they being recognized, and where are their hidden puts back, and so who's really going to end up holding this paper? That seems like the critical question here. The question of what does this tell us about sort of more embedded risk in the credit system? Or in other places, which is in a way Leroy's question. I think the thing that the board ought to be attentive to, the staff ought to be attentive to, is the fact that this is one element of a larger issue, which has been identified by the OECD economic staff on several occasions in the last year, which is the problem of compressed risk spreads in long-term credit markets globally, particularly dollar-denominated long-term credit markets. And I believe this is a very large dollar-denominated long-term credit market, and clearly risk spreads have been sufficiently compressed in this market that a lot of money went out into situations where perhaps maybe it shouldn't have or on different terms. Given that that's the case, where else are those sorts of conditions present? Where else may a lot of money have been put out on fixed income terms, where in fact the risks are much greater than the pricing under which that money was put out? And I think there's some rather obvious places, and one of them is leveraged buyouts of public companies, and the second is hedge funds. And there may be thirds and fourths, but those are the two that I'm paying attention to, and the dollars involved in both are trillions.
Other comments? Oh, excuse me, Lynn Turner.
Marty, this is starting to feel all too much like what we saw for those of us who went through the 80s and the real estate problems. This is deja vu all over. And I remember when we initially had legislation that allowed the S&S to start getting into this type of lending. And then when it started to go south on us because of the way the interest rate flips, people not managing their balance sheets in the S&L industry, then things started going really bad on us in terms of cash flows coming in on those loans. And the initial reaction and the continued reaction for several years of the banking regulators were consistent with what we're seeing from the FDIC and the banking regulators now. First of all, they put a lot of pressure on the accounting firms, the standard setter, the professional as a whole, to turn around and make exceptions or waive the rules or make accommodations such that the financial statements of those S&Ls didn't reflect economic reality. At the same time that the then comptroller of the GAO was testifying saying, we got a problem and it's a growing problem. And the GAO would go up and constantly, time after time, say we had a problem. And banking regulators would go up and say, don't worry about it. Okay, we'll be okay. And eventually they came around to the GAO's way of thinking, but we all paid $500 billion out plus to rectify that.
That was following the election. In other words, both parties were involved, so nothing was done until after the presidential election.
Right. And so here we've got even senior members of Congress involved now in writing letters to the FASB, asking once again for accommodation on the accounting rules. Because clearly under 140, if you've got the ability to go back in and gain control of the receivables, you haven't sold them. I mean, it's very principle. You ain't sold them. You still control them. They should be on your balance sheet. And yet we're finding that there's contracts being written by the mortgage servicers that say you have exactly that right. If things go bad and you have to go back and redo them and you have to go back and modify them, you didn't sell them. And yet the banking regulators are once again pressuring the accounting firms and the FASB to make that accommodation so that the financial statements, once again, just like in the 80s, aren't reflecting economic reality to investors. And I find that to be extremely disappointing. And I would certainly hope that the audit firms and profession, the FASB, would turn around and say no to that so we don't have a repeat of what we had before it. We should learn and not repeat the mistakes. And members of Congress who were out there just a year or two ago running around saying, let's defend the independence of the FASB, are the exact same ones now writing letters to the FASB saying, go make these accommodations. That's outrageous. The other thing, then, is on the securitizations, and we've seen this now for a number of years, it appears like the audit partners haven't really got in some instances, and understood the contracts and the specific terms of some of these securitizations, and understood that in reality, some of these contracts perhaps haven't met the requirements of FAS 140. And I think, especially in light of what's coming down, the firms have to be very careful that audit partners who can understand these are very complex, extremely complex agreements, that they've gone in and done their homework on these agreements so they know which ones are legitimate off-balance sheet securitizations and which ones aren't. Because what I heard up on the Hill just yesterday indicated to me that we've got audit partners that haven't recognized terms and contracts that probably didn't qualify for 140, and now as they're starting to look at them with this heightened attention, they're finding, oops, I've got errors and I've got to fix them. I hope we get those errors fixed. The last piece of it is, as you mentioned, Marty, we've certainly seen Bear Stearns and Goldman start to take some write-downs and some hits here. Before that, we saw Fremont General and some others. It's tough to believe that we don't have other people in the same position. And what happened in the 80s was we got bled to death, which is really what was the GAO's point all along, is people are trickling this in and trying to hide the losses rather than really show investors what the true losses were. And as a result, people hid, really didn't manage to loss, and it ended up costing us a whole lot more. I would hope in this case the firms who are auditing these type of institutions aren't going to allow that bleeding. People are really getting in and getting the data on these subprimes and understanding the risk, the type of loans that were being made, who the loans were being made. I know some members of Congress have turned around and said, well, we need to allow them to modify them and still keep them off the balance sheet because that'll help keep people in their homes. That isn't what's going to help keep people in loans. Their ability to make payments on loans where there's escalating interest rates or they didn't have enough equity in solving that problem is what will solve the problem. The accounting doesn't solve or put people in their homes on this issue.
Mark Olson?
Let me just make a couple of observations on the broad subject to help then focus on what I think is a really important question, and I think Leroy's question and Damon's response are really important. What should we now look for in this area? The one significant difference, let me back up. For most of consumer mortgage history, in recent years there have been two kinds of loans, conforming and non-conforming. The conforming product was the Fannie and Freddie product that Marty's extremely well familiar with. It was very carefully underwritten, and as a result, and securitized. And securitization of conforming product was a pretty good relationship, and it performed exceptionally well for both for the market and for the individuals. The non-conforming product, including the Alt A's, is a very old product. Alt A's have been around for 25 years. So it wasn't that the products themselves were new, but what was new was that the secondary market was started to warm up to the non-conforming product. And whereas previously the non-conforming product was always kept on the portfolio of the lender and not sold, therefore there was some rigor to the underwriting even in this non-conforming product. But as soon as the secondary market started to buy it, the originators no longer had any reason to be prudent in terms of the way they were underwritten. And the term came, we underwrite to the market. So whatever the market would buy, the originators would underwrite to. And that's where you got the collapse in the spread. So as you look at it, where you will get and for that reason also, most of the serious losses will be outside the banking system, because the bank regulators were pretty good about looking at whether or not the underwriting had some rigor to it. So most of it will be out of the banking system. But there will be a tremendous amount of that problem credit that's spread out throughout the market, and the enormous amount of liquidity available in the secondary market meant that a lot of that product had been purchased. So it's going to be interesting to see where it does fall out. Prospectively, you'd have to look at the same calculus. Where is there an element where the risk is not appropriately priced? Or not evaluated at all, that is going on. And I tend to think that Damon's probably right, at least in the LBO and the hedge fund market, maybe where would be next. But certainly there was no mystery with the mortgage product itself, the subprime product, that we were headed for this kind of an event.
Leroy Dennis.
Just to add what Mark said, as I thought through this as to what other industries could experience this kind of issue, and I think when you have a situation where, how Mark described, where when you were making loans in the past, the underwriter had risk of default, and today they don't. And so I think it's prudent as we think through this. What other industries are out there? Do you have a sales process that really doesn't have any skin in the game once they get the sale closed? And that might be where we find other instances like this, where you have a potential disconnect and somebody that's overselling the market, so to speak.
One comment I just want to make, Lynn, to your earlier statement about I had mentioned 140 and you brought it up. I understand there's a meeting, and Ed Trott's not here. There's a meeting at FASB on Friday to discuss the loan modification issue. And so I take to heart your concerns that hopefully the rules stay as the rules are.
FASB has put out some stuff to tee up that issue, so hopefully the FASB won't bend. I mean, they were pretty good, and actually the firms were very good during the 80s when the banking regulators kept asking them for accommodations. It's just that it's sad that we've got the regulators who pound on the auditors when they don't do a good audit of a financial institution, now pounding on them to give them accommodations and breaks from the rules. It puts the auditing profession in kind of a darned if you do and a darned if you don't, and a real roller coaster. It's unfortunate that the banking regulators are doing this to the profession all over again. Just 20 years after it cost us all $500 billion.
Is there any more comment on this particular issue? That was very helpful. Okay, it's been a long day, I know. There is one more thing I would like to get some advice from you on, if you'd like to provide it. As I mentioned, our next meeting of the Standing Advisory Group, which is going to take place in October, is our annual meeting, and that is the meeting where we ordinarily will bring to you staff's views on what our priorities ought to be for the upcoming year. And I thought, since we have a little bit of time this afternoon, if you have some thoughts you'd like to share with us in advance as to what you think our priorities ought to be, the staff would welcome those thoughts at this point. So I'll just open the floor up.
Joe Carcillo.
Yeah, I have a couple of things you might want to think about. One is, you guys have been in existence now for about 5 years, and you adopted the Auditing Standards Board standards through 102 as interim standards. Are they going to stay interim forever? It probably would be useful for the market to have some sort of a path to resolution of that status. A second issue is you adopted them through SAS 102. In the interim, the Auditing Standards Board has issued standards to SAS 114, superseding the previous standards. So you could make an argument that 12 of the standards that are now in effect for the audits of private companies, which are arguably better than the standards for audits of public companies, which is 12% of the existing interim standard base, that's a pretty significant percentage. And so there may be some usefulness in looking at 103 through 114, and either you probably won't adopt them, but come up with your own standard in those spaces. A second area would be confirmations. I know it's on the agenda for this year, but I think there needs to be further guidance on that. I think the guidance on that, or at least how it's being implemented, is seriously flawed all the way from. It's not obvious to me that in most cases audit firms know the address they're given is legitimate. When I was in public accounting, we just took it from the client. We never really questioned it. How do you know you're given the right person to send the confirmation to? How do you know the right person is responding? Side agreements have been a pervasive issue over the years. So I think there's a whole host of questions surrounding confirmations. And then the last issue would again tie back to George's group. You have 3 or 4 years now of inspection reports and a kind of a comprehensive analysis of where those inspection findings indicate problems with standards rather than problems with performance might really inform the board, I think, in a very useful way as to where new standards or modifications of existing standards need to be made.
Damon, do you have your card up? Damon Silvers.
Investors have, I think, for a long time been concerned about the fraud standard. And I'm sure that my fellow investor representatives would echo that point of view. Since Styles have the mic on, I want to say that it's noteworthy that this will be a time when hopefully the AS2, AS5 issue will not be among the things that you have to think about. And I wanted to convey both on behalf of the people I represent and on behalf of myself, our appreciation and gratitude for the work of the board and the staff around that issue. I think the deafening silence when it finally came out was really testimony to what fine work was done in somewhat difficult circumstances.
Thanks, Damon. Let me ask you a quick follow-up question with regard to the fraud standard. I sort of view it as two parts. One, sort of the conceptual auditor responsibility, the description of what the auditor is responsible for discovering, you know, reasonable assurance, et cetera, and the practical application or the approach to addressing fraud. And I wonder if you were thinking about it in terms of one or the other or both.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it in terms of both. When we've discussed this in this body, I think that there's been a pretty uniform opinion among folks coming from the investors' sort of side of things that the current standard has a conception. There is a conceptual problem hidden in the current standard, and then once you dealt with that, that you'd want to have to elaborate as to what that means in practice. And so I think unfortunately you have to do both here. And of course, you know, some people say, well, you know, it's really unfair and inappropriate to demand that auditors find all fraud, right? One hears that whenever this subject comes up, and I don't think anybody's looking for that. That's not the point. The point is that this is not an absolute liability issue, but this is an issue about setting a level of reasonable inquiry here. And I don't think the investor community thinks that that level is currently there in the standard. But I invite my friends, colleagues who, again, come from the investor perspective to weigh in here in case I've got the nuances wrong.
Lynn Turner?
I think we'd like at least the billion-dollar frauds found. Good starting point. I say, Tom, go back and look at that original letter that the investor reps of the SAG group, maybe you want to circulate that again, originally sent in. The fraud standard, as Damon mentioned, was on there. improving the communication between the auditors and investors in the form of the report was on there. Some of them that you teed up today, I think related parties was on there and fair value was on there. And there was, I think, a fifth one on there that escapes me.
What was it?
Revenue recognition.
Maybe revenue recognition was on there. But I'd go back and take a look at that one. I think it probably still pretty well holds true. The other piece is I suspect by springtime you'll have some recommendations out of the Treasury Audit Committee as well. And so you may want to be thinking about if those come in that time frame, how you're interfacing with that and that how that might impact your priorities going down the roads. So I think that could all of a sudden, before it's all said and done, have a play here with the whole thing.
Bob Tarola?
Yes, my comment is consistent with Lynn's about looking at the standard audit report, and especially as it relates or doesn't relate to the standard officer certification. The two are quite different in language and content. I find that kind of odd. And then also, as we move into this interactive data world, how will the auditor be willing to be associated with my financial statements when they're released in bits instead of as a whole? I think that's. I know that the AICPA is thinking through that, but just filing an interactive statement, it caught my attention that that I would like to have an auditor extension, if you will, associated with it. With the data as it would flow through the information supply chain instead of just flowing through without any auditor attachment.
Bob Kippers?
I guess this discussion is anticipating where you're going to be in October, so the annual priorities that you go through. I'd recommend that you take off the list engagement quality review. Take it off because by then it'll be finished. So you won't have to put it on. That would be helpful. I think we've all been anticipating the completion of that project. And I gather it's in some relatively advanced stage.
We appreciate that optimism.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, at some point you just got to do it. So I also think that, you know, again, whether you want to call it convergence or leverage, the board has to determine its own priorities with input, absolutely. But, you know, let's face it, you've got a high talent but relatively modest size staff. And so only so much can get done, you know, in sort of a linear approach. But if you were to piggyback off some of the thinking of John Kellis's group or the IAASB, excuse me, and even understanding, you know, how does this, even the ASB, which is, you know, in a different space, determine which are priority projects, you know, looking at all that might lead to some alignment and then maybe some efficiencies in terms of joint projects or whatever. I think anything that would signal that kind of cooperation would probably be good for investors.
Any other comments?
Okay, well, thank you very much. The meeting has exceeded my expectations. I appreciate all of your advice and input, and we look forward to seeing you in October. Thank you.